This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum. And today we have a conference call on some of the microgrid development updates that have been happening around the country in the last couple of months here. And a couple of people we're starting out with is Jean Okun and Baird Brown. Jean, why don't you, with microgrid energy, why don't you go ahead and start it out and tell us what's happening over in your area?
Sure. Thanks, Sierra, and good morning, everybody. My name is Gene Okun. I'm with Microgrid Energy. Our firm originates and develops microgrids in the United States and in some foreign countries, specific to those that are friendly towards remote energy development. So most recently, what we found, and I'm located on the west coast of the U.S. in California, there's been a push for more microgrids physically on the grid. I think this is in due part to some of the challenges that customers are having with their energy surety that's having them being able to operate through outages. This becomes more prevalent in the summertime, particularly now, what we're starting to see, and we were just speaking before this call about fires and things like that, and, you know, those types of disruptions to businesses, if quantified properly, can really help drive microgrid business. And so what we're finding is that there are many customers that are operating their facilities, whether it's commercial or industrial, and they have a manufacturing, they really can't afford to have their operation go offline. And so the value of the microgrid is really in the fact that they can island off of the grid when needed, both for energy surety, but also for energy savings. And so what we're seeing now is an increased demand for that here in California, as well as overseas. I've just recently been looking at about 5 opportunities in Puerto Rico, not with the government, but with industrial centers there that have put out some requests for microgrids. So as you're aware, Puerto Rico lost most of their grid, and the government is kind of in a turmoil now, and as is the utility there. Very difficult to do projects there as the there's challenges with financing and challenges with the way things are being done there. But to that end, the good thing is that the technology has continued to advance. Whether it's a solar and a battery or wind solar battery with a backup diesel, or in the case of California, we really are looking at many projects where we have natural gas cogeneration combined with energy storage and solar. And those types of mixes are really becoming, they're getting better and better on the technology side. Costs are coming down. Costs of natural gas have come down. And that really makes it more palatable for the customers. And I would say lastly, which is something that is also very interesting, is that many of the funders that understood solar in the past really didn't want to venture off into the risky battery business. But I'm finding that has been changing quite often. Now we're really coming across more and more funders that are really willing to fund energy storage and solar, you know, and this can be in a microgrid configuration. And so that's a really good thing because it's unlocking more capital to the market. It's giving customers more choices and lower cost of capital when they compete with each other. So those combined things have really, I think, started to give momentum to the microgrid market in the areas that I'm serving. And I'm seeing more of that also with schools and military opportunities as well.
Okay. Baird, what's happening over in your neck of the woods? Baird has his own company right now, and it's Eco and Law.
So, no, Eco Law, or Econ Law, but not Eco and Law.
Okay. Well, okay.
The economy is a subset of the ecology, is what the point is.
No, I certainly agree with that.
I thought I'd just mention what's going on legislatively and regulatorily a little bit. Microgrids are getting popular, and they're exciting people's imaginations, and legislators are trying to get into the act, and we're at the point where we need to protect microgrids from their friends almost as much as from their enemies. I thought I'd make a brief report on the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is Hawaii. Hawaii has made a very short piece of legislation, House Bill 2110, that will require every, it's really one utility holding company, but all the utilities in the islands to have a microgrid services tariff that provides for fair compensation for services both ways, you know, what the microgrid provides to the grid and the grid to the microgrid, streamline interconnections and makes it firmly clear that anyone can own a microgrid. This is fabulous. We should have this legislation everywhere. On the bad front, we have the District of Columbia, which this is proposed legislation. It's for distributed energy resources, and they've got a bunch of good ideas floating around in terms of some of the things that California has been doing with mapping the system and figuring out where you can put distributed energy resources as non-wires alternatives to building out more, more transmission and distribution. Having said that, they're going to establish an authority. They've already got a utility regulatory commission, a sustainable energy utility, and now they would have a distributed energy resources authority on top of all of that, and it would do the planning, and it would create an information platform, and it would run RFPs for these non-wires solutions, which anybody could compete in, and it's sort of making life more, and it's not eliminating the barriers, which there are barriers in D.C., to private ownership of microgrids. So I'm not enthusiastic about that. I'm not enthusiastic about what's happening in Puerto Rico, where they've published new regulations that in effect makes every microgrid with three or more customers into a mini public utility and requires rate regulation. So three industrial customers can't get together and have a microgrid without reporting to the Public Utility Commission and having rate filings and just and reasonable rates rather than just agreeing with each other and having a contract. And then the really ugly, especially given what Gene just said, is California Senate Bill 1339. I have no idea whether it has any legs. It doesn't address the ability of people to own microgrids and sell power to their neighbors, which are the real hang-ups in California. It does ask that there be, quote-unquote, tariffs to support microgrids without explaining that, but it doesn't deal with the ownership barriers, and it says that you can't interconnect a microgrid that uses any fossil fuel. So if you have a reason to have heating and cooling load, if you have to use natural gas anyway, you can't have cogeneration and be efficient. This is called cutting off your nose to spite your face. So we're all – I'm afraid we're entering a new phase where there's going to be a lot of well-intentioned and misguided legislative and regulatory action, and we have to keep watching – everywhere. So back to you, Sierra, or back to questions.
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, I was trying to round up Chris Carrick. He was supposed to be here this morning, but he isn't. So I don't know if he got the phone number mixed up again. Like I said, I set it in wrong. So, yes, that would be great. I see a couple other people here. Michael Walton, do you want to kind of fill in here and talk a little bit about what's happening in your area on microgrids?
Yeah. We've got sort of a wide range of things going on. I'm in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We are in Tennessee Valley Authority footprint. TVA, as a sort of federal agency that has a presidentially appointed board, is sort of unsurprisingly moving against renewables. They've either curtailed or in some cases just not issued their the programs by which people can participate in selling renewables to the grid. The result of that has actually been a great market for microgrids because they've really been strongly discouraging interconnection. And so most of the installers in our area are across the board, whether it's commercial or residential, are going behind the meter. Certainly the market for storage is improving. It's still not great where we would like to see it, but it's making more sense for them than it has in the past because of the pressure from TVA. So the kinds of projects that are happening right now, our local airport they already have 2 megawatts of solar. They're going to build a third and then add storage to do a microgrid. That's actually being done in partnership with our local power company, EPB, which is a distributor for TVA. They are working with Oak Ridge National Labs to both design and analyze the performance of the microgrid. There is a local industrial plant, a cement plant, that is in the process of designing a small microgrid. It's a cement plant. They manufacture Portland cement, and they have issues with power quality, and they also have a large brownfield on their property from just the sort of historic operation of the plant. So it's filled with cement kill dust, but the brownfield has been capped, and they don't produce cement kill dust anymore. They sort of reprocess it, but they're going to use that area that can't have trees, that has great solar access, so they're going to put a couple megawatts of solar on that brownfield, and then they're going to install storage with the solar, but really use it as almost like a giant capacitor to help with power quality for their plant. So it can't come anywhere close to, like, making their operation islandable. They just have way too much demand, but it can at least improve the power quality so that they're not affected by surges. Let's see, there have been a lot of residential microgrids going in, so people, just putting in storage behind the meter. The city of Chattanooga has a couple projects on the books where they're going to be doing solar and storage at some critical infrastructure, like the wastewater treatment plant and some of the wastewater pump stations, so that those sort of critical infrastructure components could continue to operate even in a power outage. So that's sort of what's going on here. I'm excited to hear about the progress in other parts of the country. But thank you.
Hey, Sierra.
Yes.
Lewis, I'd give an update. Got time in your here. We Clean Coalition has a project going on in.
Oh, please, please join in. That's fine.
Okay. Okay, excellent. Before I start describing the Montecito Community Microgrid initiative, I'd love to ask Baird if he has a write-up on all that legislative action. That was a really useful update. And the HB 2110 in particular sounds like a model that those of us that are involved in policy should be well aware of, and use that as a baseline for promoting legislative action in across the country. And I think Baird, you said that was in Hawaii. Is that correct?
Yeah. Let me. What I'll do is there's a larger progress in Hawaii, which is that the PUC did a report on reforming the grid in Hawaii, and then the legislature did two pieces of legislation. One is the microgrid legislation I mentioned, and the other is the complete regulatory reform legislation, which is going to completely change the incentives for the utilities and do incentive-based regulation. And two together, I think, put Hawaii way in the lead around the country, even compared to California and New York. And the legislation is short, and it mostly leaves it back to the Public Utility Commission to go ahead and do what it said it would do in the report. And so what I'll try and do is send the links to the report and the two pieces of legislation, and I'll send it to Sierra, and she can redistribute.
That would be perfect. So go ahead, please.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm going to take a couple minutes here. So did you want me to hold off, or you want me to
No, go? I would like you to explain what you're doing in that area, Craig.
Okay. Super. Yeah. Well, the gentleman, I think it was Gene, who said that there's a lot of opportunities coming as a result.
Ready for tonight.
Okay, we have to, Baird, do you want to mute your phone? I think you're the one that's not muted. We're hearing you, or Gene, one of the two. All right.
Here. Here. Are you able to hear me, Craig? Lewis?
Yeah, no, we're good right now. Huh?
Okay. All right, great. I didn't want to be Kevin along and not have it heard. So the Clean Coalition, much to what I believe it was Gene who was saying, that the disasters that are happening the state of California and around the country more broadly are creating opportunities for, what the Clean Coalition refers to as a community microgrid approach to designing and operating the grid, which is really focused on lots of local renewables and other distributed energy resources like energy storage, demand response, grid isolation strategies, et cetera. So the Clean Coalition has two initiatives in that spirit. One is called the North Bay Community Resilience Initiative, and which is at the North Bay counties of the San Francisco Bay Area, primarily focused on Sonoma and Napa counties. That's in collaboration with Pacific Gas and Electric and Marin Clean Energy and Sonoma Clean Energy or Clean Power and a bunch of community organizations as well. The other, which I'm personally more involved with, I'm Craig Lewis. I'm the
Craig, you're kind of breaking up right now.
Okay. Sorry, I'm on a cell phone and I don't have the control of I don't have an alternate phone. If the quality is not high enough, just let me know and I'll defer to next time, Sierra.
Yeah, I think you're okay right now. We just lost you for a little bit there.
Okay. Sorry about that. So we've got the North Bay Community Resilience Initiative up in the San Francisco Bay Area, North Counties, and then we've got the Montecito Community Microgrid Initiative, which I'm more directly involved with day-to-day, and that's in the Montecito area of Santa Barbara. which in Southern California, which is got devastated not only by fires, but even more significantly by the mudslides that followed the fires. And the concept there in the Montecito Community Microgrid Initiative is to do two projects. One is in the what's called the Upper Village of Montecito, and the other is on the Coast Village Road area of Montecito. And those are the two big commercial areas of Montecito that have critical facilities, to the point that was just made by the prior speaker, also have some significant opportunities for siting renewables, solar in the case of Montecito. The very first project that we're moving forward with is the Upper Village Community Microgrid, and that is going to cover the primary fire station and the headquarters for the Montecito Water District. And if for those of you who have followed the disasters in Montecito closely, you might recall that both the fire dispatch, the water dispatch, the water pumps, all of that stuff failed and did not perform even with the diesel generator backup solutions that they already have in place. So what we're doing is we're designing a community microgrid solution based on local solar combined with energy storage and demand response and hopefully grid isolation strategies, which will require the close partnership from Southern California Edison, which is the local utility that serves the Montecito area. So where we're at in that project, we've actually gotten some philanthropic fundraising or funding to pursue the stakeholder alignment piece of it, which is getting all the property owners and the municipalities and the residents, the community, the key community members to, and then hopefully the utility to kind of align and make sure that we've got support to make this project, bring it all the way to the, to a completed deployed project. And then also to begin the engineering process and get this to a permit-ready, finance-ready community microgrid. So where we're at in the Upper Village Community Microgrid projects in Montecito is we have basically gotten most of the stakeholder alignment. We've got the property owners, the municipalities. We're pretty deep into discussions with Southern California Edison. We're crossing our fingers and hopefully they will allow, be a partner and really help make the Montecito Community Microgrid Initiative really game-changing, which means that we need to be able to put grid isolation switches in place along the feeders that serve these. It's all served by single feeders, which makes it relatively easy. None of this is easy because it's super innovative when you talk about grid isolation strategies. It is relatively easy because it's all a single feeder. We have alignment with all the stakeholders, with the exception of Southern California Edison at this point. Although they're at the table, they're talking about it, contemplating how they can participate, whether they want to participate, because this pretty much opens a can of worms for them. As anybody who follows this space knows, the utilities see that there are opportunities, but there are also a lot of economic risks to them to, for this community microgrid world to really start getting traction. And most, obviously, they have a lot of competition that could come to the market, as Baird was alluding to, with some of those bills. And they also have they have full knowledge that one of the biggest cash cows, probably the biggest cash cow in the world today, is investing in transmission infrastructure. And when you start to get a lot of DER, guess what? You don't need as much transmission infrastructure. So that takes away one of their cash cow opportunities, which obviously is a big threat to their economics. So with all that said, the Upper Montecito Village Community Microgrid Project is progressing. We have a Plan A and a Plan B. So Plan A is with Southern California Edison participating. Plan B is we kind of stick everything behind the meters, due to some virtual net metering programs that are placed, we can actually accomplish what we, kind of 80% of what we want to, even without Southern California Edison's robust partnership collaboration. The goal at this point is the first instance of the Upper Village Community Microgrid will be designed, permit ready, finance ready by the end of the year. We're on track for that. We're in the middle of engineering design and kind of working with we're kind of testing and kind of screening potential engineering procurement construction EPC players to build it out. If folks are familiar, we do need more technical support. I'm trying to hire an engineer in Santa Barbara that has good knowledge of these things. If you know somebody in Santa Barbara or would like to move to Santa Barbara with those kind of talents, let me know, please. But I do expect that we will have our initial design for the kernel of the Upper Village, which is the fire district headquarters, which is the primary fire station as well, and the water district. Those are adjacent properties. And the water district is not only in their headquarters location, but they also have pumps that circulate a good amount of water to the area. So that's our kernel. That design will be done by the end of the year and will be built out over the course of 2019. And meanwhile, in parallel, we will be looking to find out there's a number of schools in the area, so those will be emergency sheltering sites. They're all served by the same feeder, so it's this beautiful thing that can tie all these things together, hopefully by utilizing the existing feeder, distribution grid feeder. And as I alluded to, that's going to require a partnership from Southern California Edison, local utility that owns all those distribution assets. So I'll leave it at that. We've got information on our website about the Montecito Community Microgrid Initiative. If you want details, and we've got information about the Bay Community Resilience Initiative as well, up in the San Francisco Bay Area, if that's more of your geographic interest. But I'll leave it there, Sierra, and happy to take any questions that might be out there.
All right. Do we have any? We have quite a few people on here who are probably quite interested in this conversation. I have one person at 317-296. Can you identify yourself, please? I don't know who you are.
This is Evan Hughes. I called in on Skype. I don't know how it shows up on your screen.
Yeah. Are you on 317?
No.
Yeah, okay, so I'm looking for somebody who's on 317 area code. Who might that be? Okay. All right, mystery person. If you get through, please just go ahead and let me know. Anyhow, okay, that's great. Some interesting conversations are going on here, so please feel free to dive in with questions. John Kinch, do you have any questions? I see that you're on right now.
Hi, Sierra. Yeah, this is John Kinch with Michigan Energy Options. We're a clean energy nonprofit. We just recently submitted a proposal to the USDA to look at solar plus storage to build some resiliency in some community facilities in rural parts of the state. We haven't heard back from them on our proposal yet, but I'm interested in that idea. We don't have much of that going on at all in Michigan in terms of using a microgrid with solar plus storage for resiliency anywhere in the state except for maybe a couple of very isolated small projects that are utility controlled. So I'd be curious to hear from your speakers about that particular niche and whether they have more of that going on where they are than where I am.
Anybody else? Go ahead. Identify yourself.
This is Gene. I can just comment that I think, depending on what state you're in and what utilities you're dealing with and which public utilities commission, obviously there's more advanced grid activities going on, particularly, as Baird alluded to, in Hawaii. They're trying to reach 100% renewable target. And that's almost physically impossible with the way the transmission is without adding energy storage. And so once you add that component layer in, then it also becomes difficult for the utility because now suddenly they're kind of – people are wondering what they're doing there anymore. So ultimately, I think, as Baird said, that utility rate basing is changing to the point so much that – they may be reinventing the rate-based type of a wheel, if you will, and I think other utilities like California and that Public Utilities Commission, as they have their 50% target already being, you know, met and targeted, they're already talking about 100%. And so I think there's going to be a lot of change coming forward, and utilities are obviously going to have to change their model and their role of what they are, much like cell phones were. And I think, you know, we might find the utility of the future is just merely running the utility lines, but they're not involved in any of the power production or generation or even the storage part of it. And I think, you know, in terms of Michigan and other areas of the country, I think those are ripe for opportunities because they're in early stages, but the benefit they have is that they can look at the other states where things have been developed, and they don't have to reinvent the wheel. They can look at things where, you know, it's very advanced and sort of leapfrog, you know, into the latest and greatest technologies, and doing so with the right consultants and the right people that are able to steer them. Clean Coalition and others like that can actually provide a lot of benefit to those utilities and those Public Utility Commission to, you know, put together the proper framework for the microgrid development in those particular states. Side to that, you know, I'm a proponent of kind of all things energy, so I don't, as California is maybe struggling with fossil fuel generation and cogen, which is still very efficient for certain customers. States in the north and northeast that experience longer-term cold weather, and you're physically heating the building with gas anyway, ultimately there's a real opportunity there to provide those types of microgrids where you're doing that in a manner of combining cogeneration with solar and battery. And so you kind of get the best of all worlds. So I think it's just going to be an early stage process is going to be slow, but those states will come online pretty quickly once they start to see how it's being done elsewhere.
Any other?
No,
go ahead.
Yeah, this is Shalom Flank in Washington, D.C.
Oh, hi, Shalom. What is your phone number, Shalom? Is it the 317 number?
No, I'm calling in on Google Voice, so it's probably showing up as a 205 number.
Yeah, I don't see you on here at all. Huh, interesting. I didn't know you were there. No, please, go ahead.
So at some point in the conversation, I really want to come back to Baird's point about the Distributed Energy Resource Authority approach for non-wires alternatives. But first, Gene, you were just describing the combined solar plus cogen kinds of microgrids. And one issue that we've encountered, I'm curious if folks have a solution for this. In jurisdictions that have, you know, relatively new community solar regulations, if you've got a microgrid and you've got that kind of CHP base load, but then you've got multiple megawatts of solar distributed within the microgrid and a single point of common coupling to the rest of the grid, but then the community solar regulations say that you have to connect upstream of the meter and do 100% export. So how do you make the solar resources within the microgrid work under community solar regulations if they're kind of behind the microgrid meter? I don't know if other folks have encountered that or come up with a way for addressing it.
Anybody?
It's interesting, Shalom. I haven't come across that yet. So that's a very interesting situation that you are dealing with right now on the community solar side of it.
It's more than one jurisdiction too. So that's why I was wondering if other folks have seen it.
Well,
this is Baird. There's about a dozen jurisdictions. Go ahead. Someone.
Yeah, sorry. This is Craig Lewis. The question I have clarifying this on this community solar question is, you know, batteries don't create energy, right? They just store it and ship it for availability at a different time. So if you actually want to tie that community solar into the community microgrid, then you have to have those attached, right? There has to be a connection between the community solar project and the battery. That can all be done on the utility side of the meter. There's no problem with that.
the question is, how do you make sure that solar plus storage can continue to provide power to the critical loads? You're not going to want to have solar being providing, you know, power to all the loads, which I think was having that solar plus storage. And whatnot. Generally, you have it in that scenario. You have that storage available to the critical loads. You turn off all the non-critical loads, and you are usually only providing to about 10% of your normal load. But in the case of the community solar project, it's the same kind of calculus, and that's where you have to get the utility to participate, because what the utility is going to have to do is figure out how to make sure that you can grid isolate, and if the grid goes down, you can continue to tie solar and the storage that would be attached to it, and keep the distribution feeders on so that that power can keep, you know, providing power to the critical loads of the hospital, the police station, fire station, blah, 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 whatever the community considers critical facilities.
Craig, you were cutting in and out a little bit, but if I can rephrase to make sure we're saying the same thing, whether you're talking about CHP plus storage CHP plus solar or storage plus solar, if you want to put the solar export upstream of the meter on the utility side, or if you want to connect the battery upstream on the utility side, then if you also want to get those resiliency benefits, you've got to have the grid isolation part, the switchgear, the sectionalizing equipment, a little further upstream from the battery, and you've got to be able to have the microgrid operate that sectionalizing gear so that when there's an outage, you can take advantage of what's actually ahead of the meter and therefore not customer or microgrid owned. So that seems like a mess.
I think you've captured it correctly. I will just say, hopefully more simply, that the grid isolation configuration has to be above all of those assets, all of those, the solar and storage, whatever other generating sources you might have, and whatever critical loads that you might want to keep online in grid outage scenarios, they all have to be within the grid isolation, grid sectionalization configuration, right? And it doesn't matter really what side of the meter everything's on, other than, you know, we're all trying to figure out what programs, you know, the utilities have in whatever areas. But if you're starting with, you know, blank canvas, you'd probably put almost all of these assets on the utility side of the meter, the solar, the storage, everything else, and just have the grid isolation equipment so that it properly, you know, can connect the, you know, the solar and the energy to the critical loads, which is ultimately what we're trying to achieve in the grid outage scenario.
This is Baird. I mean, what you're raising, I mean, what you're getting here is a bunch of engineering solutions to a regulatory problem. In other words,
yes,
you know, a state has done a stupid thing. They've tried to authorize, you know, communities to gather and do things, and they've done it in such a narrow way that they've made it difficult for people to flexibly do even better things. And that it's clearing away those barriers and not accepting them as an engineering necessity that, I mean, you know, we're trying to do projects now. If they're big enough projects and they're really kind of you've got the buy-in of the utility and you can do a utility-private partnership and you know, that's the sort of Hudson Yards model. That's all great, but otherwise we should be clearing out barriers to local ownership and sharing of power. And there are workarounds. I won't go into it. Regulatory workarounds you can get to in states with either customer choice, retail choice, or good co-op laws or other things like that that may be better than the engineering workaround.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, in some jurisdictions like New Jersey, where I'm working on some of the VPU town center microgrid projects that people may be familiar with, their community solar program is in a pilot stage. They have posited this kind of 100% export upstream of the meter approach, but they're still working it out, and the town center microgrid projects are specifically tasked with giving feedback to the BPU about how to improve the regulations so that you don't wind up in the situation Baird was just describing, where bad regulations are driving unpleasant engineering choices.
This is Michael Walton in Chattanooga. I think another thing to to think about as far as this conversation goes is it's sort of an issue of grid modernization as well. So we have a fiber optic backed smart grid with interrupters that sort of manage this process, this sort of upstream island.
And the rest of us are all jealous of that, yes.
Yeah. So I just wanted to sort of throw that in there as a, you know, in some cases, you know, as the grid is modernized in other parts of the country, you know, some of these issues might go away.
Definitely. Sarah, if I could, can I come back to the issue of the non-wires alternatives?
Oh, sure. The conversations just go whatever direction you want, so that's fine.
Okay. Because I think, Gene, you started us off talking about the value that microgrids provide for single-site resiliency, and those of us who are developing projects, you know, that's clearly a major driver. But I think we're seeing now the outlines of how the value can be delivered for larger sections of the grid, not just the end users within the microgrid. And that's with these non-wires alternatives, where you identify an area where there are grid constraints, usually capacity-based grid constraints. It's particularly good in the urban setting where there are lots of different options for how to address that other than building new wires capacity, new substations. But I think it works, like Craig, for some of your products, the Mendocino, the Northern California, the more remote areas as well, where you're essentially taking something like the capacity markets that exist at the ISO level, where there's a dollar per kilowatt payment for peak capacity that can be delivered on demand, and bringing that down to the feeder level and providing capacity payments so that you don't have to build the substation, and so that microgrids and other solutions can become as standard as substations, a part of the toolkit, part of what the utility can rate base in maintaining the reliability and the stability of the larger grid. So there, that's what the Distributed Energy Resource Authority approach is designed to do in the DC legislation. And the only reason it's set up as another authority is because we haven't seen any of the existing institutions as being capable of doing that job. But I'm curious about people's experience in other jurisdictions that might be heading in that direction and how it's being handled.
But just to be clear, Selim, I'm very much in favor of those kinds of larger resiliency pockets being formed and turned into microgrids, and to the extent that there's a way to do that, whether, you know, I guess I'm generally in favor, but whether the way to do that is to form a separate entity from all of the above, who doesn't really have the ability to override some of the other entities, or make, you know, or force them into a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
God bless them.
Well,
right. I mean, they're still clearly. Go ahead.
This is Craig Lewis again, and the Clean Coalition has an initiative that's really kind of far out there. It's probably our longest time frame initiative we have, called the Distribution System Operator Initiative. And I think what is being described for the DC area is essentially a DSO, a Distribution System Operator, and the regulatory body. Because somebody's going to have to regulate it if it's providing service to, you know, everyday ratepayers.
Yeah, Craig, you're breaking up again, but I agree with you. Distribution system operator that has the responsibility for finding least cost solutions to maintain performance of the distribution system, that's a natural place for those non-wires alternatives to be on a level playing field with the wires and substation kinds of investments. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that would be, if you have the operator and owner of those that distribution system with a different regulatory regime that gives it incentives to do that, then you have the power to accomplish what you want to accomplish along with the incentives, as opposed to having one person with the incentives and another person with the power.
Right. Although isn't that setting up distribution system operator, isn't that also creating yet another institution that only has a part of the job and is still operating within constraints from other institutions? I mean, that just seems inherent.
Well, I was taking it that the distribution system operator was, the entity formerly known as a distribution company.
Okay. So if it's the same as the utility, then... But that's a big culture shift for utility to move directly into that role.
That's what you're.
So what
right
does the
now?
Clean Coalition have in mind?
Yeah, so the Clean Coalition what we have in mind is that the existing utility, which in California, and this is kind of a California-focused construct at the moment, but you have integrated utilities that own both transmission and distribution, and so the Clean Coalition's distribution system operator initiative is to essentially force the utilities to divest from their transmission assets, and that will force them to be focused strictly on the distribution grids, and will therefore overnight bring huge, powerful competitors into innovating on the distribution grid, which is exactly what the Clean Coalition wants the world to really be focused as much as possible at the local level. And there will also, whoever buys those transmission assets is obviously going to be very well funded and have lots of financial incentive to compete as hard as they can to continue for this central generation type of world. But we need some real players with both financial and lobbying capacity to really be fighting hard for the distribution system operator future. And I think the way to do that is to get the existing utilities to be focused solely on the distribution grids. Because right now, their biggest cash cow is transmission investment. So how in the world are they really going to fight hard for distribution, grid solutions if they know that they're eating their primary cash cow? So we do believe that there's going to be a regulatory body that's going to have to control the DSOs. So that's kind of where the trickiest part of this whole thing comes in. And it's heartening to me that Washington, D.C. is already trying to figure this out. So I'd love to see that legislation and connect whoever wants to be connected with Doug Karpa, who's the Clean Coalition's team member leading the DSO initiative here.
Let me just say one thing here. I'd like to invite anybody else who has not already spoken to participate in the conversation. Do we have anybody else, or are we all good?
Yeah, actually, this is Rob Kamen.
Hi, Rob. Yeah, I was going to see if you wanted to join in here. Go ahead.
Yeah. Actually, I got a question for all the folks on the line. So I'm kind of curious at this stage. I mean, we hear Hawaii's going great guns. Their cost per kilowatt hour is over, high 20s. We hear TVA's going with microgrid. Their cost per kilowatt hour is probably down sub 10. I'm just kind of curious, on a residential, medium commercial, large microgrid, what's kind of the range of financed offers that are out there now?
Anybody?
Well, I can chime in.
Yeah, go ahead, Shalom.
Go ahead and introduce yourself, so please. Everybody knows. Yeah,
this is Shalom. Projects we're working on Northeast, mix of solar and natural gas CHP, we're usually able to offer in the kind of 10, 11, maybe 12 cent kilowatt hour range, along with the resiliency benefits and the emission reductions and whatever other value the end users might see in the microgrid. So I don't know if that answers the question.
I can,
yeah, that's great. And then, yeah, for solar with CHP. And then I heard some people talking about residential, which, you know, clearly isn't CHP. It'd be solar and some storage, and wonder where that's offering at, and where we're getting down to with just solar and battery, or elsewhere with solar and CHP and battery.
This is Michael. I can at least give you the numbers that we're seeing. We're in the, you know, $15,000 to $20,000 installed cost range for residential, and another let's say $5,000 to $7,000 for the battery system. That's about a 10 kWh battery.
This is Craig. The Coalition works mostly at commercial scale, so I can't speak to the residential, but for the community microgrids that we're designing, the solar is priced at, you know, let's call it 10 cents a kilowatt hour, plus or minus, and we're kind of at, you know, 500 kilowatt sized installations or larger, and the unbuilt environments, rooftops, parking structures, and or parking lots, parking structures, and then the battery cost is basically, this would be for a battery to be 100% dispatchable, meaning that it makes solar available whenever you want it. You can shift it to midnight if you wanted that solar energy to be provisioned at midnight. It's at about 15 cents a kilowatt hour for whatever critical load or, you know, demand charge management or whatever it is that you're trying to use that battery for. It's essentially going to add about 15 cents a kilowatt hour for the capacity of that battery. The way to think about the battery is if you want your battery to be sized to use a megawatt hour of energy per day, right? It's on a per day basis, then that's going to, you know, add 15 cents per, multiply it by the number of kilowatt hours that a battery capacity contains.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Anybody else here? We've got a few more minutes.
This is Evan. I have a question about the, what was it, Craig talking about the Montecito project and said there was something also in the Bay Area, or someone spoke
of
a similar project in the Bay Area. What was the Bay Area project? Right.
It's called the North Bay Community Resilience Initiative, and courtesy of like I've taken too much airtime, I just say that the Coalition website has a pretty robust information available on the North Bay Community Resilience Initiative and on the Microgrid Initiative, and I would just point you to the Coalition website for information. But if you have additional questions, just reach out to me, you know, at egg@clean-coalition.org, and I'll be happy to, you know, talk more about it.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else?
If nobody else jumping in,
go ahead.
I have another question.
Good.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Hi. This is Shalom again. We've been talking a lot about solar and CHP. We're also doing some microgrids that are a little more thermally focused with a campus-wide condenser loop for that services water source heat pumps, but uses external thermal sources and sinks like sewer heat mining, solar walls, et cetera. I'm just wondering if other folks are also pursuing similar lines or seeing projects like that on a kind of campus scale, you know, multi-million square foot kinds of approaches.
This is Craig again. Project in partnership with Stanford University, and you're probably aware of Stanford district heating and cooling solution that they have on their main campus. Stanford is building a administrative campus in Redwood City, which is, you know, about 5 miles away from their main campus, and they're putting a mini version of their district heating and cooling in there. It is a grid that we're I'm currently designing with Stanford. Information on that is available on our Peninsula Advanced Energy Community
webpage. Stanford's a big part of that that community microgrid solution, which is in a disadvantaged part of Redwood City in California.
Okay, good. Yeah, I didn't know about the Redwood City. Great.
And Shalom, the University of Missouri, for its science and technology campus at RALA, has done a campus-wide geothermal. It's not a microgrid as such, but it might be interesting to talk to them.
Excellent. Thanks, folks. Very helpful.
Jason, you're still there? Do you have any comments on any of this? I guess not. All right. Kleena, anything happening in your area?
Well, we've got some new legislation passed this past session to encourage smart grids for the utilities. I'm not sure it's going to open up much on the customer side of the meter, so we're just kind of waiting and seeing what the utilities are going to put in on the regulatory front now that the legislator said the basically the PUC has to approve whatever they put in. So we're kind of watching and waiting.
Okay.
We are light years away from Hawaii.
I think everybody's light years away from Hawaii. Well, at least everybody's working in that direction, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, anything else here? Okay. Well,
I just want to say this is one of the best calls that I've been participated in. So thank you for bringing all these wonderful people together who are doing some really awesome work. And I hope we can have a follow-on conversation on this. Maybe do this like once a quarter because there is a lot of action going on out there. And I think this is a great forum for just keeping everybody up to date and helping learn from each other.
Oh, good. I appreciate the feedback. Yes, I'll definitely do that. I'm always trying to find, well, there's so many really important topics, it's really hard to sometimes narrow it down. So I try to be a little bit diverse so they're not all the same thing all the time. But we have another person who is not with us right now, and I didn't want to even bring him in because there's so much stuff going on in this area that I knew it would take most of the call just to even talk about that. So it was related to microgrids. So we'll go ahead and do that, and probably in another month I'll come back with another microgrid-related call because there's a few people that we don't have on the call that I'd like to see here. So, all right. Well, okay, so we have a webinar next week and it's talking about assets, and that should be extremely interesting with a couple different people who are involved in managing the assets of the solar particularly and what to do and what not to do. So please join us on the 18th, and I'll be looking for the invitations. Thanks for everybody for coming, and I hope to see you next time.
Thanks, Sierra.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
Sierra. Have a good day.